The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
So we will move to the general public. We have over 350 folks signed up. So we have a lot of folks today.
A vote today for this paper is a public endorsement of war, of human rights abuse, of militarized streets in our city, and a destruction of the constitutional protections of speech, due process, representation, and ultimately dissent.
I witnessed how people would get purposefully incarcerated just because there were no societal structures to provide food or shelter, so they would commit crimes just to receive their basic needs. And that made me ask, you know, where's the millions of dollars for housing? Where's the millions of dollars for food that people need and are like best desperately begging for?
I'm in awe of the beauty of this, my city, my community, but I'm so disheartened and frankly disgusted by our elected officials continuing to ignore our cries for justice, continuing to not honor your promises to represent the constituents who put you in those seats.
And what you're doing is you're sending more militarized police into our neighborhoods. We don't want it. The people do not want it. And your job is to represent the people. And when you don't do that, you're failing. You're failing, and you're a failure.
The vote is 11 yays. The vote is 11 yays, 4 nays. The motion to adopt as amended carries. Madam Clerk, please call the adjourning roll.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Sounds from Monday's Atlanta City Council meeting, and it was historic for so many reasons. In that clip, you heard, of course, City Council President Doug Shipman officially starting the public comment portion of the meeting. And then we heard from so many, a local nurse, Jess, local Reverend, this has identified, local Reverend Chase Oliver, human rights activist, Reverend James Woodall, a nurse for Georgia's prison system who goes by the name Vanessa. They were among the crowd that overwhelmingly opposed the building of Atlanta's new public safety training center. Now, this full council meeting passed millions in funding to help build the controversial center, or what many opponents refer to as Cop City. As you heard, the vote was 11 in favor and 4 opposed. Hundreds spoke during the meeting, so many that the council voted to allow one extra hour of public comment after already hearing 12 hours of speakers. And you add in the council business, and it was nearly 14 hours, if not more. More than 300 signed up to speak, including Clifton Kelly, citing his occupation as an advanced EMT for DeKalb County.
Firefighters and EMS personnel are being burnt out at an unprecedented rate. Turnover has a significant impact on morale. Suicide and PTSD rates in our profession are higher than active duty military personnel at this point. We need downtime to recuperate from the calls that we run and the things that we see. That requires staffing, which requires that you pay us what we've already earned with our literal blood, sweat, and tears. If you took the additional $67 million being proposed for this Cop City site and put it towards our compensation, you would see a massive increase in patient outcomes and patient care. I know that you all gave yourself a $12,000 raise a couple of years ago, so we would love some of that money. Thank you.
Just one of the many different perspectives. There were some tense exchanges between the public and some council members as well. Councilmember Antonio Lewis took offense to one speaker questioning Lewis's service to the 12th district that he represents.
I understand that we full out in Pittsburgh, but I'll let you know that, man, I'm full out in my district every single day. Hey, you can't hold my jock strap in my community talking about you helping in my community, because ain't nobody help us.
Boy, your community ain't past you, bro. Hey, listen, hold up. Nah, let me tell you this.
Let me tell you this, man.
And I stand
Let me tell you this.
And I stand on that.
Let me tell you this, boy.
You know
let
I me tell
you
that.
Hey, Ruffy, just don't grab the mic. Just don't grab
okay,
it.
I won't grab it. I got you.
And I'm a no-vote. And I'm an easy no-vote.
Most easy no-vote.
Boy, shut up. Listen, the only reason you're in that seat is because we had to replace Dre Shepard. And I promise you, you're not too long for that seat, buddy. I promise you, the way that you acting, the way that you was campaigning against Cop City while you was running, and the way that you're acting right now, I promise you, you're not going to be too long for that seat, bro. Bet on that.
Thank you.
Councilmember Michael Julian Bonds' father, civil rights giant Julian Bonds' name, was mentioned by a speaker, which Councilmember Bond took offense to.
I would just ask for the courtesy as we respect the Muskogee ancestors. If you would respect my ancestor, that you would respect my father. Thank you. And he just as we all hold those who've gone before us in dear care, if you want to criticize someone, please criticize me and don't invoke my father's memory, please. Okay.
And after the final vote, which again was 11 in favor to 4 opposed, many took to social media, of course, to express their own views, including the Reverend Bernice King, who tweeted, quote, "How can Atlanta City Council members vote yes on hashtag Cop City funding and live with their conscience after hearing today's public comments, many of which were passionate, love-centered, powerful, and inspiring," close quote. Councilmember Keisha Shawn Waite spoke with Morning Edition's Lisa Ram about voting no, and Waite cited several concerns.
One is the lack of transparency. The $67 million price tag processed doesn't go through the normal procurement and contracting process that the city of Atlanta has. It's been almost clandestine. Those types of things erode public trust and confidence in a project. There was an activist, a protester, that was killed at that property. That was shot a number of times. We've called for an independent investigation as to what occurred. It's my understanding it wasn't an APD officer, but nonetheless, it happened at that particular property. So my feeling is that the process on its face is tainted. The individuals who actually live and reside in that community, they really have not been able to give input other than public comment. A lack of desire to go out to truly explain the process by having town hall meetings all over the city to allow individuals to weigh in, to get their perspective. The unanswered questions surrounding human remains being on the property, you know, if they're either there or they are not, those questions have not been answered. And finally, the environmental impact for the forest in terms of how it impacts those who live and reside in that particular area. I want to be clear about my no vote. I do believe we need a facility. I think that's important. I think the process, however, that we went about with this was a level of disrespect to the voters. We had 14 hours of public comment. And I think that it's very clear that we did not have the public support in terms of making this decision. And so my heart is breaking for those who came and engaged in the democratic process only to be denied. As elected officials, Lisa, we are charged with carrying out the will and vote of the public. And I don't believe that happened this morning.
Waite went on and said, due to the public outcry, the council could have taken more time before the final vote.
You have nearly 1,000 people who stayed up all night long. Lisa, I've never seen this. I've been engaged in this process for nearly 2 decades. I served as a former state representative where I've been at the state capitol until midnight many times. I have never seen the type of engagement, the type of commitment where people stayed all night long to make sure that their voice was on record. And I believe to be insulted, we could have at least sent it back to committee to have gotten this right. We could have at least sent it back to committee to give us more time to answer some of the unanswered questions, to make sure that this was properly vetted.
And something else Waite said that she cited that stood out to her.
the young people who came down and were engaged in the process. Lisa, I didn't get engaged in the political process until very, very late in life. Hearing the young people come out and speak, I think was the most compelling thing. But for the neighbors, the people who live in that neighborhood, to say, we don't know who is saying that these are outside agitators, but hey, we live here. This is our community. And we're here to tell you unequivocally that we do not want this project.
Closer Look reached out to several city council members, many citing simply being tired and unable to join today. We can tell you Councilmember Matt Westmoreland has agreed. He voted in favor of the funding and he will join Closer Look tomorrow. And one final thought. The role of a credible press is crucial. It is the ability of journalists to report freely on those public interest issues. And it's also crucial. It's a crucial indicator of democracy. So I take this time to recognize the hard work from our WABE News and digital team, as well as so many other dedicated journalists throughout Atlanta. For full coverage, visit WABE.org. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
First of all, that is not our boy Jay-Z on this track. That is a hip-hop group, Alta, that took an AI-generated version of Jay-Z's voice, y'all gonna get sued, and put it in their new song, Savages. There's a reason I said that. We're going somewhere. It's one of the many ways artificial intelligence is becoming a part of our reality. AI is already powering personalized shopping, administrative and educational assistance. Well, that's debatable if it's assisting. And self-driving cars and all that good stuff. And according to the management consultants at Gartner, businesses relying on AI grew by 270% over the past 4 years. And according to another entity, Servon Global Solutions, 95% of customer interactions will be powered by AI within the next 2 years. So get ready. Now, these statistics, depending on who you ask, they could be troubling or, hey, it's welcome. It depends on who you ask in the tech industry, including the experts who brought AI to life. And we've discussed this so many times here on Closer Look. Georgia, of course, is a major tech hub, and especially here in the Atlanta region. So what does this accelerated use of artificial intelligence mean for our futures? Well, let's ask the folks who probably have better insight than I do. We begin with Larry Williams. He's the president and CEO of the Technology Association of Georgia. And Dr. Beverly Wright, head of data science for Birch. Is it Birch?
Did I get it right? Birchworks.
Birch. I appreciate it. Thank you both for taking the time. Let's just get it out of the way. I'll start with you, Dr. Wright. AI gonna, it's, we're doomed, right? Yes, no?
We're just doomed. We're so doomed.
I'm just kidding.
I know, I know.
Where do you stand on this?
I mean, well, I'm cautiously optimistic. Ah. I mean, we are definitely seeing some areas that make a whole lot of sense. For example, safety related. You know, why would you want to risk a human's life to crawl up onto that giant tower, you know, hundreds of feet in the air, instead of just using a drone or finding another way to do that and having the AI come up with a way to solve that problem. Other types of things that are dangerous or efficient. And then you have, you know, the positive side of it too, where it can help save lives or create other organs. So it's definitely a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. So the future we'll see, you know, we'll see more AI, of course, integrated into different areas of our lives that maybe we're not even thinking of right now.
All right. We'll talk more about that. Larry, the good, the bad, and the ugly. If I had the Clint Eastwood theme song, for, was it Fistful of Dollars? I'd be playing it.
That's a good one. What was the good, the bad, and the ugly? Oh, yeah. Was the movie.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, delighted to be here. Thanks so much for having us. You know, I think it is that balance of, you know, is it, are they tools or are they weapons? And I think, you know, at the first thing as we build this out is there's so much unknown right now. We have the opportunity to build it so that it is that they, these are tools and that we make sure that the humans are in charge and that we have to build out certain things that provide great governance, great policies, and great laws about how we implement these wonderful tools or what can be wonderful tools to really can benefit and improve our lives.
Let me stay with you for a moment because you just said something that, was interesting. You said, well, if the humans are in charge, I think perhaps maybe that's something that scares people because they think we're talking about the humans won't be in charge. Is that what something you think people get wrong about AI or is it a valid concern?
You know, I'm not that concerned about it because I think that we will be in charge and that we will build it and we'll build it out in a way that
makes sure. But what about Jack out in Conyers, who's like, I don't know. I'm not convinced.
Well, then I think Jack's got to continue to do his research and see how things are that are going. I mean, so I think if we think about some of the positive things, again, you know, healthcare, I think, is a great one. If we think about cancer research, one of the biggest research and also the diagnostics, one of the biggest things that can help save a person's life in cancer is early detection. If we implement these tools so that they actually go forward and they can detect a cancerous cell. Imagine just a single cell before it's mutated and spread into other tissue. That is a great benefit. And the other one, just real quick, is, you know, there are a lot of people with diabetes throughout the country. It's a big problem. It's one of the most prolific chronic diseases we have. One of the symptoms of that or one of the reactions is blindness. There are a lot of people that can't get to an ophthalmologist. So imagine using your phone, scanning your own eye, and using an AI technology that could detect something that could save your sight ahead of time.
And we'll talk about that because, believe it or not, not everybody has a smartphone, you know, or if they have a smartphone, maybe they don't have access to Wi-Fi. So we'll get into equity and all that stuff a little bit later. But Dr. Brown, let me bring you back to the original question, which was fears that humans can't control the accelerated success of what's coming with AI that, and I know it sounds like a movie, the machines will take over. But
it does sound a little bit like a movie.
Yeah.
As someone who works in this field and started with data science and AI, well, it wasn't called AI back then. What we were doing was more data science and analytics. You have to understand that the person is programming. There's still a person programming. There's still someone that's directing. Even if you're using what we call in data science prescriptive analytics, where you're prescribing, you're asking the machine, hey, tell me which way to turn. You know, there's the old story of UPS, which everybody's heard, that they don't turn left.
Right.
I want to catch them one day in a neighborhood turning left. I feel like I could do that. But where do you think that comes from? AI has to enable those routes that are optimized. And therefore, it's prescribing, it's telling the driver exactly which route to take. Now, it's not doing that on its own will.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
The machine has been programmed to, hey, I'm asking you to tell me what to do.
Let me follow up with this, since you were talking about research. Is there enough research that's being conducted through your lens to make sure we're catching all of the potential pitfalls? For example, with cars, and we know there have been, the car will... because it's mapped with the streets, it knows when it gets to a red light. But, you know, there is someone who, a jogger comes out of nowhere. You know, perhaps the instinct,
you see where I'm going.
Is the research catching up to catch all the pitfalls before this, whatever the new AI product is going to be, it gets put on the consumers?
Right. I think where we're catching up, to use your phrase, is the ethics. You know, maybe the research is done as part of the ethical framework. But I think that our technology has progressed at a rate that has surpassed the ethics that should be in tandem with it. That's a little bit of a concern.
Okay, let's talk about that for a moment because I have been reading about, it was some, and these were small police departments or sheriff departments, I can't remember which, where they were using AI to try and determine a profile of a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to a suspect of color,
mm-hmm.
in particular, we're talking about it was a black man here. And they got the wrong person.
Yep.
They went after the wrong person. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So the research needs to get back in a lab or whatever you call it. And to fix this, and the ethical part of that as well.
Right. Agreed. So there's something called adversarial AI. I don't know if you've heard of it, but if you take a stop sign and you were talking about self-driving cars or autonomous vehicles, if you take a stop sign and you add four pieces of tape, okay, it doesn't seem like very much. They're not that big. You add four pieces of tape, but if it's the right color and in the right place, the car won't be able to see that as a stop sign,
mm-hmm.
right? That's not a very funny practical joke.
No.
You know, and I'm not sure that our systems are advanced enough to think through those sorts of scenarios. Some are deliberate, maybe,
mm-hmm.
like just blind spots that we're not paying enough attention to. And then other things are just, we didn't know that people were going to think of this as a practical joke and start marking up stop signs.
Yeah. Well,
so yeah, we've definitely got some catching up to do.
Well,
from
an AI cannot predict human behavior, can it?
Oh, sure it can. If it's told
well,
to
bad
do that.
Human behavior.
Well, that's a little bit harder. The bad actors are where we get in trouble. Yep.
Larry, let me come over to you and talking about Dr. Wright talked about ethics over there. Yeah, there's been some progress, but a whole lot more that needs to happen. Want to get your thoughts on that?
Oh, by all means. I mean, so the ethics of this, it goes into good ethics, good morale. Good morals will also provide good policies, which go to good laws, good governance as well. And then how we actually implement this and build these people. You know, I don't think this is in a place right now where we're going to turn the nuclear codes over to the machines by any means. We're going to make sure that the humans are involved. And it's interesting that you mentioned the thing about cars, autonomous vehicles mm-hmm. in particular. You know, out on the West Coast, they have been having them out on the road. And there was a headline one time, two autonomous cars almost collided.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in general newspaper. The tech magazine said they didn't collide. They did what they were supposed to do. They detected each other and they actually evaded a collision whenever they came too close. So this is evolving technology. This is things that we're starting to get more right in certain circumstances than get wrong, but we continue to learn from it.
And I think also a question a lot of people have is, you know, because listen, as folks, we're used to regulations, right? There's a regulation for this, regulation for that. When it comes to risk assessment, should there be some type of overarching governing body that, you know, we have the FDA for certain things. We have consumer protections for what, you know, we even have, you know, the FCC so that I don't start cussing and, you know, get away with it. So should there be some overarching, and should it be a governmental body that says, look, before you roll this out, whether it's a VTR headset or, you know, a new smart speaker, it has to go through this governing body.
Right. I think if there's one thing that we've learned by sort of letting this organically grow is that the companies in and of themselves are not enough. It's not enough. They may come up with policies on their own or different kind of strategies for keeping the ethical AI at bay, but as far as collaborating with other companies or different universities and schools. And I mean, you've got to get everybody sort of in a technology community on the same page. So the only way that I know to really do that is through regulation and government.
So you're saying we got to leave it up to Congress.
I know, right? Scary.
I'm just saying because, you know.
There's got to be something in place, though.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Larry?
Yeah, by all means. And I think you'll see within the next 12 or 18 months, you're going to see Congress act on this. There is already talks about it in creating an agency
mm-hmm.
that will have oversight. It takes a while. 5 years ago, we started the Cyber and Information Security Administration mm-hmm. within the Department of Homeland Security, all focused on cybersecurity and providing some policies and some governance on that. This is going to be similar. I'm not sure where it's going to be housed, but these discussions and negotiations are already happening, and I think you'll see something in the next 12 to 18 months.
If you're just joining the conversation, we are talking about artificial intelligence, or as we plain folks always say, AI, and I'm talking with Larry Williams and Dr. Beverly Wright. Now, listen, if we have this body, of course, that's people like, yeah, that's great. But then also, too, how do you make sure that there aren't external influences? We have lobbyists for pretty much everything. So if you were writing legislation, What's the one thing you would want in there, Dr. Wright?
Multidisciplinary. It needs to be a multidisciplinary kind of initiative or board or governing body that involves ethicists, data scientists, different, you know, people from nonprofits, business people. It's got to have a combination, because I'm trying to think of a place where AI will not impact our world, and I really can't.
Larry, if you were writing legislation, if you had to get one piece of a provision in there, what would it be?
We'll go with two. One is a consumer perspective, and the other is the practitioner perspective, meaning it can't just be vendors of AI solutions, because they that their solution is the solution. So I agree with Dr. Wright, multidisciplinary, but include consumers and also the practitioners.
Would you like to see this, I guess, obviously start here in the U.S. or just North America, or, you know, like we have the World Health Organization, which declared a pandemic, which says this is what it is for the entire planet. So would you like to maybe start here and then have something bigger?
I think there's going to be so much variation by country that it makes sense to me to have it separate by United States.
Well, we have
first,
a climate accord. Could we have an artificial intelligence accord?
Eventually, yes. But I think starting with the United States makes sense. Hey, one more comment, too, related to the regulation that you probably saw this, but the CEO of OpenAI that owns mm-hmm. ChatGPT recently spoke to Senate and said, listen, there's a potential for this to go really wrong. Things are great right now, but there's a potential. Yeah. So I'm glad that we're talking about this today.
Well, let's you know, and beside when I said Jack and Conyers, I don't know if there's a Jack and Conyers. I just threw it out there. Somebody already sent me an email. Who is that? Don't worry about it. Listen to the show. Let's talk about ChatGPT for mm-hmm. a moment. Because students, and if you're folks that don't know, students are using, not just students, but other folks are using this, and not necessarily for good. Dr. Wright, would you just give a little?
Yep. It is a tricky conversation. The question that I think most companies and leaders of these companies are asking themselves right now is, should we allow ChatGPT on our corporate machines? Mm-hmm. Once you start getting into the rabbit hole of ChatGPT and you start querying and then you're contributing to this, what you have to be careful about what you say and what you don't say. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the tricks.
Larry, what are your thoughts on?
I think we have to have good ethics and good morality around this. On one hand, it can accelerate the ability to do research. Think about the days and weeks that you spend in the library researching a topic so you could write that term paper. Mm-hmm. What if you could accelerate that? The key part is going to be the human equation that comes in afterwards, after the research, that actually puts a unique perspective on that data and comes to unique conclusions. That's the part we need to focus in on, and that's the part we can't lose.
So I'm going to tell you about a conversation I had with a good friend who's listening, but I won't mention that friend's name, obviously. Friend had a project due. Friend used some system here where the friend took their notes and everything from the class, put it into this whatever, and then it came out with the paper.
Yep.
I'm just saying what my friend said. Mm-hmm. And said, I didn't do anything wrong. These are my notes. I took the notes. I researched the other information I wanted to put, and then I just used this software to formulate it into a paper.
Yep.
Is that? I said, look, hey.
Yeah, I've worked in higher education for over two decades, and I've had different perspectives from students all across the world that think just because you can, that means that you should.
And here's the other argument that I heard. Was that the way we teach now. Mm-hmm. And often we just want the student to regurgitate the information back. Mm-hmm. But if the student is able to take the information and put it in a way that shows that they understand this course or whatever, there shouldn't be anything wrong with that. We have technology for everything, when we do certain, you know, calculus or whatever, you know, equations, we have technology. So what's the difference?
The difference is that the real objective is that you're trying to get someone to learn certain content. And the way that that learning can manifest itself is the way that somebody communicates the summary of it. Mm-hmm. That's the whole reason we ask them to write papers. We're not looking for the actual paper in and of itself. Mm-hmm. We're looking for a demonstration that they've actually absorbed and can apply the learnings. That's mm-hmm. the way that we do that. By having a machine do it, what they're really doing is they're taking the manifestation of what other people have learned, mm-hmm. and it's summarized through the ChatGPT results.
Ooh, you see these emails.
I bet.
What do you want to add to that?
Well, By all means, it's the point that I was making before. It's got to be that human equation. You know, what's unique? I mean, you can ask, you know, whatever system to spit out a song, write a poem, write your, you know, spouses, your significant others.
Create a fake Jay-Z for a song.
Exactly, right. As you
come on,
introduced
y'all.
This.
Stop, yeah.
But I think at some point we're going to start to be able to detect some of these things. Mm-hmm. I mean, so what's the real thing? If I took your friend as an example, if I came back and I read that and said, yes, this is a reflection of my real work and my real perspective, or not, mm-hmm. and if my ethics say not, I need to start over.
All right. Before we take a break, I'm going to bring another guest in, and you all are more than welcome to stay. I want to talk about what folks should prepare for in terms of a future that incorporates more AI. What would you want to, if you want to even, whether or not you want to ease their concerns or for folks who are excited, what do you want them to know about how we should prepare?
They need to think about this as something that, you know, like Larry mentioned earlier, is more like a tool. It's something for humans to use. It's at our disposal. Imagine how revolutionary it was when we found fire, you know, or when the hammer was invented. This is sort of like that. It's not, you got to think about the other side of the equations. Like if you were to flip the conversation and say that.
Well, we were all excited about a microwave at one point.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly.
Stay away from the microwave. But just, that's
well,
what they tell you.
In data science, we were all excited about machine learning. Yeah. And I actually think that term's going to get less and less airplay, no pun intended, because it's just going to be the way we do data science. We're not going to have to distinguish that it's machine learning. You know, in the same way, AI is going to become more integrated into what we do. I mean, I took a typing class in high school.
It was required, wasn't it?
It was required.
Same here.
Yeah, and can you believe
thank
that?
Thank you, it's Sister Clarette, for teaching me how to type.
That's right. Yeah. Now it's just part of our daily lives.
Larry, what do you want folks to know in terms of preparing for a future that incorporates more AI?
Well, I think when we look at it as a tool, then we look at the massive amount of calculations and interpretations that can go into cybersecurity and how it can keep our cyber world safer. I think about AI and its predictive analytics. Mm-hmm. It can detect when a storm is coming, the path that it's taking. Right now, the predictions of where a hurricane is coming off the coast, it's almost 180 degrees of where it might happen or broader. Just think about being able to narrow that down, know where the impact's going to be, save lives by evacuating, or being able to mobilize the right Red Cross and other resources so they're attacking and providing the resources in an immediate time. That's powerful.
Now, when we come back, of course, as with any conversation we typically have on this program or any issue, there are concerns about populations that might get left out, left behind. There's equity. There's all of that. So stay tuned. There's more Closer Look after this. And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. As we continue today's topic regarding artificial intelligence, now we know, as we just talked about, tech and AI, it's revolutionary, okay? It's revolutionizing the way we live, work, and learn, but it is also an industry that not everyone has access to. And according to the federal government's report on diversity and workers and tech, so we're about 14% of Asian Americans, 8% are Hispanic, and 7% are African Americans. And only 2% of African Americans and 11% of Asian Americans are in executive roles within the tech industry. Now, those numbers seem especially disproportionate locally when you consider that Georgia is seen as this growing tech hub and ranks 6th in the nation for startup opportunities. But there's another portion of that, too, when we talk about AI and concerns of what populations and communities will be left out in terms of the technology, just how it enhances our daily lives. So there's a whole lot to talk about. The Technology Association of Georgia says there are too many walls in the tech industry and not enough bridges. And so their Bridge Builders program was created. And we'll talk about all of this with Dr. Loretta Daniels. She's the director of TAG Bridge Builders. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I want to begin with the same question I asked the guest before. When you think about AI and where we are in our daily lives and how we use it and as an industry, what's the good, what's the bad, what's the challenging?
Well, I think the challenge is for our community. Is to make sure there's access to it, right? Mm-hmm. To make sure that we're not left behind, that we can have access to the training, we can have access to the jobs, those kind of things.
And so perhaps that leads then to making sure communities, certain communities, aren't left out of this accelerated innovation that we're on.
Exactly.
So that's the whole point of that.
Yeah.
Let's get a little personal. Let's back up. How long have you been working in this space?
I've been working with TAG since August, so fairly new, in leadership roles and in this space for about 20 years.
And in terms of leadership from mentors, were there many people that look like you? You identify as a woman of color. Did you see a lot of folks, mentors, executives, that you could say, hey, you know, tell me about your journey. Tell me about this industry.
Unfortunately, no.
None.
None. You know, there's rare. I remember being in my first senior leadership role. I was the only one around the table. And so, you know, we have to speak up. We have to have our voice. But we do need people to help us get there, you know, and that's a part of what TAG Bridge Builders does.
And so when we talk about diversifying, I had a nickel for every time I said that on this show, and diversifying the tech industry, I usually hear people say, well, it starts with increasing the pipeline. And that could take decades to get that person or those individuals to get into executive positions or mentoring positions. This is 2023. Are we doing enough, seeing enough now in terms of these diversifying initiatives that in 10 or 15, 20 years, we'll see more of executives and leaders like you?
And it starts with access. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the major things that we do with TAG Bridge Builders. Before I took on the role here with TAG, I was really offered opportunities to come in and build a DEI space for tech, right? Companies were saying, we want to get diverse talent. To give you an example, a company had 100 jobs. Mm-hmm. They wanted to fill these tech jobs with, you know, making sure they're including diverse talent. But they were saying, I'm challenged. I can't find it. But I've got to get these jobs filled.
What does diverse talent look like? For you, how you define it, and perhaps was there a difference in how the companies were viewing diverse talent, like it's a checkbox?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were looking for minorities to say, here, we have now a culture of minorities. We're hiring minorities into our fold.
People of color, what does that mean? Is it because Black, Hispanic, Asian American, Pacific Islander, you know, and also diverse is beyond how folks identify in terms of skin color.
Yeah, they were looking to say, how do we hire Black talent? How do we hire minority talent? And so what they were doing is saying, I'm struggling. I need to get these jobs filled, but it's all about a strategy. And so if they were looking to get these jobs filled, but doing the same things that they were doing before, they won't be able to hire anyone in that position.
What were the, whether intentional or not, or missteps, or simply they didn't have an idea? What was that? They didn't know how to reach out to, because Morehouse College has a lot of talent. Spelman with Spellbots has a lot of talent.
Just not using the strategies. It's more than saying, here's a job. You know, telling a university, here's a job we're hiring. It's about intentionally creating relationships. So that you know that these companies and these universities can fill those talent pools.
But also, Dr. Daniels, I'm curious because when we have these conversations, and folks know, we've had so many of these conversations, people come on the show and they talk about they want diversity and they want to be this, but it also begins with the culture of the said organization.
It does. That's one of the reasons why it's so important not to have the D, E, and I, but the B that belongs to it, right? That's the belonging. Because you can go in and hire, you know, those talents, but if you hire them and they don't feel like they are a part of the culture, a part of the progress, a part of the revenue, a part of the growth, they move on. So one of the things that I think is crucial is we need to make sure that we have a strategy to help them. So TAG has built a Black talent resume database to say, here's a strategy. Now we have qualified Black talent for you that you can go into this database. We use AI to say, here, now we're going to match this up with all of your job requirements. And now you have someone who's 90% or 100% or 80%. So now you can hire them into this position.
I want to shift for a moment because a big focus of today's segment, which has nothing to do with the city council meeting, as far as I know yet, as it relates to AI, because as you mentioned, coming into this program, the whole purpose of having a diverse tech field, and particularly if we're talking about artificial intelligence, is to make sure, because representation matters, you have people from different communities and populations who can also say, listen, let's make sure with all this great advancements we have with AI, we are not either A, being discriminatory, or we're also keeping in mind the quality of life or the lived experiences of these said folks. Mm-hmm. What concerns you with AI in that regard?
Well, what concerns me is if you are not using AI to erase the bias, you know, to allow someone to get into a position, to erase all of those characteristics of bias, you know, where you've gone to school, what a church affiliation you have, those things can really prevent someone to enter into the workforce. So that's why we've taken a dual approach. Companies need to take a dual approach. They need to have something that says, here, I'm going to scrub out all of these identifiers that would prevent someone from coming into the workplace. But also, I'm going to use a tool that attracts those that I'm looking for.
Take that further. And I can see listeners saying, well, wait. So you want to use AI in the good for this.
Mm-hmm.
For job hunters.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to using AI for facial recognition, like at the airport or as I mentioned, a law enforcement agency that was using it to come up with a profile for a suspect, mm-hmm. and it went terribly wrong.
Yep.
So
AI can be used for good or bad. And that's why it's really so important to be able to identify those areas that you can play a positive role when you're introducing AI into your organization.
Those who are able to make that determination or approval for introducing AI, they have to be what you recommend they be, or as much as possible, if it's a department or even one person, mm-hmm. that person have some type of DEI training. Here we go with DEI training.
Right. It's a sensitivity.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't know what you don't know, you know, when it comes to diversity.
What do you mean by that?
Well, to give you an example, when it comes to hiring, if you're going to create a product or service, you have to really understand, how does this affect this particular person or this community? How is this product or service going to benefit? Is there something that would be considered discriminatory about mm-hmm. this product? If you don't have a diverse team of thought around the table, then you're only having this one group of people adding into the conversation.
I get that. And I think you can understand someone listening saying, well, yeah, but 2023, folks should be able to look around a room. And if everybody is white and or male, or everybody's from, you know, the New England area and they work here and the business is located in the South. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like it's a be a no brainer, right?
You would.
He's
think.
A tech folk. They supposed to be smart.
You would.
Oh, think. I'll get an email about that.
You would think so, but it goes back to the point is, I can't find qualified black tech talent, or I can't find diverse talent. So it promotes from within, and that brings me to like a succession plan. Mm-hmm. One of the most important things about a succession plan is to make sure that if you're bringing individuals in on an entry level, there's stats that show at a mid-level for tech professionals, they advance at a level of maybe 10% of what their counterparts advance.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not getting an opportunity to go to senior level positions to be around the table to make those decisions.
So who needs to, and I don't know if training is the right word. Now let's be really clear, because during 2020, everybody went out and got a DEI expert. Now we're hearing that with layoffs and everything, the first area to go is DEI. Mm-hmm. Everybody put out statements regarding their commitment to DEI and all of that, and social justice issues and all of that. But who needs to come in and set this platform, this environment for folks?
It starts with leadership. One of the things that TAG, because we're so intentional about making sure that we are very inclusive, to make sure our member corporations are as well, it starts with succession planning, and succession planning means who's going to put this person into the next level. Typically, a succession plan includes someone trusts that looks mm-hmm. like them, that they can trust. But a succession plan should be bias-free. So anyone with particular skill sets for that next job or requirements, everyone mm-hmm. should be able to go into the succession plan. And this is something that we've done. We've created a succession plan that removes bias mm-hmm. and that social capital. Because if you don't do that, you will never have that diverse thought around the table at a senior leadership role.
That process works. You've seen it work.
Yes, it works.
Someone listening says, well, then, okay, do I just go out and buy the software? You know, folks always want to just buy stuff. It doesn't work like that.
About training.
It's not a plug and play.
Mm-hmm. It's about being intentional. It's about saying, oh, we've got a succession plan, but take a look at who's sitting in leadership roles. Mm-hmm. You know, where does your succession plan stop? So that's what you have to do. I would encourage any company, if you think that you want to make sure that your succession plan is equitable, you need to make sure that you're looking at who's around the table in the leadership roles. If you don't see diversity around the table in the leadership roles, then you need to go back and revisit it.
You told me moments ago that there were many times when you were at the table, you looked around, there was no one that looked like you. Mm-hmm. So now when you're at said table, perhaps in a similar environment, is some difference there? Is it still just you and maybe a few other folk?
Some companies you won't see it. Other companies are very progressive. They're trying. But you have to look a little closer, because you will see them at the mid-level, several, but mm-hmm. you will not see them in that C-suite. And so you want to make sure that these companies are looking to progress. You can't say that I want DEI as an initiative. You've got to say it. You want it as a strategy.
In an industry like tech, which is a huge umbrella, we get mm-hmm. it. One would think that this is the perfect model. This is the template, because tech is about, for some folks, it's about improvements, right? Mm-hmm. For whatever sector, every part of our life, or whatever. That's what it's about. Technology's mm-hmm. about. It's forever evolving. If we get to a point where perhaps someone says, well, we're at this point where technology has really improved one's quality of life, then does it really matter if there aren't a percentage of Black women or LGBTQ folks, or, you know, those who might have physical challenges, because it's improved everyone's life? So, you know, is there a better way to ask is there some magic number, or is there some magic metric that you look at to say, hey, we're doing pretty good in tech. Look at these numbers, or look at this, or look how we've improved everyone's quality of life.
Yeah, you know, the quality of life, tech is all about coding. Tech is all about advancement. And you have to have diverse thought when it comes to inputting that information into coding. You have to have that. You can't have that if everyone looks the same around the table, whether it's Black or white. You have to have the diversity.
I'm 51 and I joined the tech industry in 93. At this juncture, I'm still one of the few Black men at this level, way more than the 90s and mid 2000s, but we still have to code switch to succeed. If these folks discover, you know, the difference between field, green, and arugula, you're guaranteed more opportunities. It's a sad but true commentary. And you understand what that's saying, because I do.
Yeah. Well, what would you say? How would you react to that?
See, I am the host, so I'm asking questions.
You know, I'm saying that basically you have to make sure that you understand as a corporation, you're never going to be there unless you have that diverse thought. You are never going to be there if you think you've arrived there at this number.
I'll add this. I always encourage, when I speak to students or my own nieces and nephews, be yourself. Be who you are when you look in the mirror. Mm-hmm.
And know what you have to bring to the table.
Yeah.
You know, if you've gotten that degree, if you've gotten that experience, if you've gotten that certification, you have to go in and you have to know how valuable you are. And you have to know what you can bring to the table.
If there are some bullet points you want people to take away from this conversation that you and I we've just been having for the last 20 minutes, and in what ways diverse hires improve the future of tech?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked me that question, because the number one reason why DEI is something that when the economy goes away, you're going to get cuts. It's because companies see it as an initiative. They check off the boxes. They have to see it as a business strategy. It has to be incorporated not just in HR and to have, you know, ethnic groups. You have to look at it as a process for increasing revenue, arresting attrition. It has to be in the overall fabric of a company. It is not an initiative. It's a way of life for a business. Mm-hmm. And if they take the opportunity to look at it that way, then they will see growth.
I mentioned Atlanta being this great hub, and I think a big part of it is because of the institutions that are here. There are mm-hmm. some fabulous institutions. We know we have some Fortune 500 companies here. We know that Atlanta's become this tech, you know, sort of incubator. Where do you see this region in maybe the next 5 or 10 years?
I see tremendous growth because there are a lot of organizations, whether it's community organizations and business organizations, that are beginning to partner, to look at the ecosystem to see here, how do we make sure we're advancing the needle? And it's not just a checkoff box for everyone.
How do you see tech being part of or at the intersection of social justice or other grassroots movements?
Because it starts with the individual. And if you can have one individual in the government, in corporate, in higher education, who champions this and understands it, takes the time to understand it, that's when you'll see advancement.
Dr. Loretta Daniels, director of the Bridge Builders Program at TAG. Thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for being part of this conversation. Good conversation. Somebody sent me their resume. Somebody give it to her.
We're accepting it.
You know what? Hey, I'm going to pass it on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson, Daniel Razel, and Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Soria Vanderwerth. No AI there. We have a real person on the board. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as on our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Stay tuned to WABE from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.